I'm Bronwyn Williams, futurist and trained analyst, and this is Local Logic, where we help South Africa's technology leaders unlock the real power of data and AI in their technology stack. Join me as I sit down with Dr. Bongani Andy Mbaso, CTO of Altron Group, on building secure data and AI-driven digital transformation. Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron, because local expertise drives global results. Hello, I'm Bronwyn Williams, your host for Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron. Today, as usual, I'm joined by Dr. Andy Mbaso, the CTO of the Altron Group. And today, our guest who's with us from the other side of the world is Dr. Vivian Ming. I thought I'd start off by asking Dr. Ming to introduce yourself and your work as it relates to the intersection of value and values when it comes to ethics in technology.
Wow, value and values. That could be a big, complicated question, but I'm Vivian Ming. I am a scientist. I made the very strange choice of studying brains and machines. So I'm both a computational neuroscientist and a psychologist here at UC Berkeley. But many years ago, I had the terrible idea of starting an education company using artificial intelligence. And as horrible as the experience was, I got hooked. I think I just got involved, terrible number, in my 13th company, almost literally this week. So I love this idea of being able to take truly the sort of bleeding edge of what technology can do, and particularly machine learning and artificial intelligence. But my only interest, paradoxically, is how we make better people, whether it's neuroprosthetics, building devices to directly interface with the brain, all the way through to using AI, for example, to reunite orphan refugees with their extended family members, or in a very personal story, building an AI system to treat my own son's diabetes. In the end, for me, it's always just about people. And I guess the values and value proposition is my real main job is that I run a philanthropic lab and people bring me challenging problems. Many of them have very sick children. Some of them have countries and they just don't know what to do about education or about economic inclusion. And if I think my team and I have some unique insight to offer, I pay for everything, and whatever we invent, we give away. And that, to me, is the biggest driver of value I could possibly imagine doing, is understanding how we can make better people in the most fundamental sense. And it's values because I believe in it so much that I'm willing to simply invest in a future in which these things exist.
That's quite the opening statement, and we'd certainly love to come back to you in just a second with some of those problems that you have been involved with solving. But I'm going to turn to you now, Andy, and picking up on what Vivian was speaking about when it comes to making better people, how do you think that technology can help make better people for organizations?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Bronwyn. Always nice to join the podcast with you. And it's nice to meet Vivian. It's really great. I've actually had some interactions with UC Berkeley. I love the folks there. So yeah, when I used to work at an R&D lab, we had some guys from UC Berkeley come and visit us. This is like 10 years ago, so this is a long time ago. I doubt anyone is still there. But it's really great to kind of reconnect with someone from there. As you know, Bronwyn, you know, we'd like to say at Altron that we believe AI adoption is about empowering people. So, you know, I was smiling when Vivian was talking, you know, when she says for her, it's about people, because that's exactly how we've anchored it. You know, we see that every single technological innovation that's come up has always led to, you know, a couple of things. I think number one is it's led to a change in the labor market. And the change has always been net positive. I know people are always scared in the beginning because, you know, there's a new machine that can do something much quicker. But the labor market always adapts. You know, we forget that it's a market. It adapts. It figures out how it ought to, you know, how it ought to be in order to survive in this new world. And so for us, we see that as something that is fundamentally about empowering people. We believe that if you can empower people to do more, be more productive, then you can have higher targets. You can achieve your goals that you, you know, maybe are 10, 15 years away. You can potentially push that forward, right? And achieve it in 5 years. So for us, that's what it's about. And that's the conversation that we take to our customers as well, right? To go, or see it as an accelerator. Technology is an accelerator to help you achieve your company objectives. And look at it as an enabler to go, what could I enable, right? What lever could I pull to help me achieve those company objectives in a much quicker turnaround time? And we've seen that message be really responded to and resonating with a lot of C-suite executives in our customer base.
Thanks, Andy. Back to you, Vivian, because Andy's pulling on a lot of threads. A lot of the questions around ethics and artificial intelligence or technology in general can be broken down in different ways. The one way that it can be broken down is should we be doing this at all just because we can? The other one also looks at fear people have of adopting new technologies like Andy's spoken about. People worried about moving their cheese or stealing their lunch rather than focusing on how it can actually enable and empower them. And maybe you can speak a little bit to the point of where you see both companies and individuals getting this wrong. What are some of the biggest misconceptions you have encountered or misplaced intelligence and op-eds when it comes to the conversation of ethics and technology?
Where do I even start? We're human, so of course we get all sorts of things wrong. Not me, obviously. I'm always right about everything. But the rest of humanity, you know, there aren't that many villains in the world. There's just a whole lot of humans. And literally, there are limitations to what our brains can do. It's worth understanding there are limitations to what an artificial brain can do as well. We have different sorts of strengths. And that begin to kind of provide my answer. I see myself as an AI realist. I built my first model in 1999. And, you know, as some people may have heard before, if they've ever heard me share these stories, that model was actually from money from the CIA. We were doing facial analysis for lie detection. I'm an undergrad, and this is my honors thesis. But you know, I also got to use that exact same technology years later and advance it, to reunite those, orphan refugees by analyzing their faces and creating a tool for their family members to find them. I got to build a system for the Google Glass, the little blue thing behind me there, to help autistic children learn how to understand facial expressions. So, it would be facile to just say AI is just a tool. It's what we do with it that matters. The thing is, it's entirely true. When you say that AI will always create more jobs than it destroys, I actually believe that that's very likely true. You never truly know what's going to happen in a future that hasn't happened yet, but there's no reason to believe that won't be true. But I ask another kind of a question. Who will be qualified to fill those jobs? So me as an AI realist, not a utopianist, not a dystopianist, I'm not worried about Skynet. I grew up as a sci-fi nerd. I know all of the stories. But that's not my concern, nor is it you sprinkle GPUs on every problem and they magically go away. Cures for everything. Humans frolic in the sun for the rest of our existence. What we're looking at is an astonishingly powerful technology, maybe the most powerful thing humanity has ever invented. But what's interesting about it, from my own research, and I'm sure we'll have a chance to get into the specifics, is it is this incredibly complicated, dynamical system that interacts with us. A big part of what we put into it is what we get back. And if you put nothing into it and it answers all your questions for you, which a disturbing number of both students and employees are choosing to do today, then, you know, hey, the truth is, on average, it makes us a little better for certain tasks. But there are concerns with, are you forgetting how to do your job or ever learning how to do it in the first place? And even bigger ones, me as a neuroscientist, we see early evidence, for example, of increased cognitive decline and erasure of cognitive factors in humans. So it's easy to sound overblown here, but these are real concerns for me. Because on the other hand, you have the people that interact with these tools in complex, dynamical ways. Instead of just deciding to outsource their job to a machine, or even, as some had called it, a centaur. Some jobs are human jobs, some are machines. So I'm going to send all the boring stuff to the machine. Guess what? If the machines do all the boring stuff, you get more boring stuff. If AI reads and writes all of your emails, you get more emails, not fewer. We need machines that challenge us to be better ourselves, that explicitly support our creative work. And that is an immense realizable possibility with AI. So I guess what I'm saying here is my concern is a very slippery slope into a shallow, easy, efficiency-obsessed engagement with artificial intelligence. Quick, easy boosts. You know, it's like cocaine for productivity numbers. On the other hand, what is transformative? Where, instead of marketing slop, do we get cures for cancer? And that comes from deep, effortful engagement, engagement that really requires, forgive me, cyborgs, where there isn't a clear line between what the machine and the human is doing, this constant engagement. I wrote a whole book about it, actually, as it turns out, that'll be out soon. But this is what is simultaneously what excites me and concerns me, because all of this is about our choices. We can keep investing in building better technology, and we probably should, maybe not quite at the fever pitch we are today, just to make certain we don't get ahead of ourselves. We need to start investing in people. You want better AI? Build better people.
That's a powerful point. I want to pick up on what you were saying there. One of my good friends, John Sulls, one of the partners at the Foundation in the UK, just published a wonderful piece saying AI is making the easy things easier and the hard things harder, which is kind of speaking to what you're speaking about, these sort of separating effects that we can be investing in, and these feedback loops of the technologies that we engage with, the technologies that we incentivize, the technologies that we incentivize our employees to use, how are they feeding back into us? So I'll get to the questions of things around bias and bad data too, but Andy, I wanted to come in around those sort of programming loops when it comes to really the safety and efficacy of deploying AI in organizations without thinking through how these loops are interacting back with us. And again, there's a case study that might spark some thought. One of the big tech companies has just been revealed, I'm not going to name names, they don't need any more airtime, that they have encouraged their staff to employ a chatbot to define their own KPIs and OKRs for next year. So they're basically being encouraged not to think about what they're going to do next. And it's very interesting to see how we deploy these things, how we feed them, and the cycles, either vicious or virtuous, that we might be inadvertently feeding or encouraging or discouraging. So what are your comments there when it comes to enterprise wisdom?
Yeah. Yeah. No, thanks for that, Bronwyn. Look, I want to maybe classify it in two ways. You know, we always think about AI safety as, you know, the external stuff, you know, the things that we need to make sure we get right training data, make sure that it's not biased, make sure that it complies to policy, the regulatory laws, make sure it's secure, right? There's no data exfiltration, etc. But we actually forget the internal, right? I want to call it human agency. I'll give you an example with the way I use AI, right? I actually feel more challenged when I'm using AI and I can achieve a lot more, right? I almost feel like it's my own person. You know, if you've watched Iron Man, where Tony Stark is busy designing something and there's like this AI that's just ambient and it's just helping him to design stuff. I feel like that. I really truly feel like that. I've got so many ideas and I feel like I don't have enough time to do all of them. And I feel like this thing helps me to move a little bit faster. So I'm not actually doing less challenging work. Actually, I'm taking on more challenging things. And so I'm growing, right? My agency is actually reinforced. It's not diminished. And I think that the challenge that I've seen in organizations, and we are dealing with this even ourselves as an organization, is where employees then outsource their thinking, right? Completely to the tool. And then they submit it as their own work. I mean, that for me, I'm just like, do you not have any pride in your work? You know, it's astonishing the amount of people that do that. And I don't think C-suite executives care enough about that, right? To really make sure that the skill of really co-creating, dancing with AI, is what we call that in our organization, is really taught to their employees. Many people just empower them to go, here's the tools, go away and figure it out. And often what you get back is this, you know, because we're humans, right? It's easy to be lazy. It's easy to go, let me just outsource my thinking to this thing. Hey, here's a client. They want a new brief. Here's a client. They want a new design on something. And we just outsource that to AI, and we lose our agency. We lose that magic touch, you know, that we sprinkle. Vivian, I like what you said around, you know, it's not the GPUs that add the magic touch. It's actually still the human creativity. But it's about how we can unlock that and unleash that in a much more powerful way. So that's what we've seen in organizations. It's often easier to spot the external stuff. And many of our customers have started with that, writing down policies, making sure that its data is secure, picking the right tool, etc. But often they don't, you know, focus enough on the employee, right, and their agency. And how are we supporting their agency to ensure that they can deliver on the results of the organization and the objectives of the organization?
You know, if I might actually support that with a little bit of research, and there's an increasing number of actual experimental research going into this. We can even start with Anthropic, that has, I think, to their credit, the makers of Claude, if you're not familiar, have released reports on how Claude is used by different groups in different ways. And for example, among university students, they looked at how students engaged with Claude and broke it up roughly into four groups, sort of having fun, using Claude for search, using Claude for evaluation, and using it for creativity. Now, I'm sure creativity includes a whole lot of just write this essay for me. Might also involve some co-creation. I'm sure both of those are going on. What's interesting to me is about equal, almost thirds of students are having fun doing search and doing creativity. Almost no students are doing evaluation. Claude, what am I getting wrong? Critique my essay. Give me feedback on my plans. Was something like 5% of students were engaged in that way. By the way, that kind of tells me about 5% of students are probably truly co-creating using Claude. And when we look at examples of research, a really cool study done with Procter & Gamble in product development, a study out of MIT that got a lot of press with students writing essays while they tracked brain activity, and finally another one looking at building arguments, trying to convince other people. When ideas and essays were truly co-created by individuals or even written by hand with no help whatsoever, what you find is third parties are more persuaded by their arguments. When teams with machines truly co-created ideas in that Procter & Gamble study, they not only read better, had better punctuation, they were cleaner, but the ideas were more likely to receive awards and actually be picked up for development. So if you're talking about value creation, it is the true co-creation that makes the difference. And when you just outsource it, it's so easy. It's so fast. I mean, anyone that's, I don't know if anyone's tried Gemini 3 yet. I have. Wow, what it can do is astonishing. And yet, when you don't do it yourself, you can't remember. You don't feel ownership. There's very little neural activity, very little evidence that you're actually cognitively engaged in the process. All of these are huge warning signs, but even if you don't care about that, surely you want your marketing campaign to be persuasive. And the evidence shows that purely machine-generated systems are not. And surely you want your product development to lead to groundbreaking products that truly disrupt the market. And again, that Procter & Gamble study shows it was only the co-creation through machine and human that produced that. You get better rated stuff when it's crafted by a machine because, and I'll be clear, even my grad students, I wish that their punctuation, like just their fundamental writing skills, were as good as any LLM, but they are not. And to be honest, I just finished writing a book. Of our approach, you know, is that they often say writing is rewriting. Well, it isn't for an LLM. And so it spits out this very slick, engaging material, which can be deep, but it's not, when you leave out the human, what it almost never is taking you to someplace new, someplace transformative. And so that co-creation, true co-creation is important, and keep that 5% number in mind. If you're simply letting this free flow into your organization and you're not thoughtful about it, or God forbid, you're doing what you just mentioned, you're encouraging them to let it make decisions for them, then that 5% of people who will engage deeply, that won't be your result. It'll be the 95.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's so spot on. Maybe I should play open cards here. So I'm actually a reviewer for the journal Ethics and Technology. It's headed by Luciano Furudi. I'm sure you know him because he's quite famous in that field. My PhD was actually interdisciplinary. It was ethics and computer science because I was trying to build a moral robot. So as it turns out, we've selected Claude in our organization. We only use Claude for many reasons, but most of the reasons is around the safety and the care that I feel they go through in really trying to understand how an LLM impacts, you know, humanity, how humanity interacts with it, and how we should safely adopt it. I mean, something as simple as you still can't generate an image out of Claude. And my boss the other day was asking me, but Gemini can do it. ChatGPT can do it. Why aren't we adopting that? I was like, well, what's the first thing that you're going to generate? Like, if you're just an employee sitting at a corner, what's the first thing you're going to generate? And it's going to be not safe for work content. I mean, it always ends up there. And so I really love the care they've kind of taken. And I'm not saying that they're the end all and be all. There's lots of, you know, kind of safety teams that are now starting to come up. And thankfully, you know, they're starting to be recognized as a first, you know, as part of the table, right? You know, having a seat at the table where these decisions are made to build these models. So couldn't agree more, Vivian.
It's worth noting, Joshua Sold Dickinson, the first author on the original diffusion models paper, is a former lab mate of mine. At UC Berkeley, and he wrote a whole blog post apologizing for having invented diffusion models. If you're not, don't know, the models that create images. So this is what some people feel about owning the result of this. Again, not because obviously some incredibly probability flow. What does that even mean? Some incredibly sophisticated mathematical model somehow means he's a bad guy. But if you don't think about it, I'm sure to get into ethics. Ethics for me isn't a checklist. It isn't a bunch of wise men with beards on an advisory council. Ethics is, do you own the whole problem? Do you own the consequences of your technology? If you're here to improve education, have you actually demonstrated that your AI tutor not only works right now in the moment with your idealized students, but works for everybody in all contexts, that they never just figure out how to get the answer out of it, which, by the way, that's exactly what students do. And the result is they never learn anything. So do you own the whole problem? I know problem solving and ethics don't totally feel like the same thing, but for 30 years, people have brought me incredibly complicated problems. And I would argue, quite honestly, it's 99% of the game is really feeling like, I don't think I understand this problem. It's starting with one of the most basics in all of sort of innovation research, start with a why exercise until you hit the rock bottom of that exploration. Why are we doing this? Then I guarantee you, you do not understand the problem you're trying to solve, and the AI you deploy might well make things worse. Not because you're a bad person, not because AI is bad, but because you didn't understand the problem. You do that much, and then what's left over is sort of more traditional ethics, as we might think of it. And I think there's a lot to be said there, but it starts with why.
Andy, do you want to come in there with maybe some more specifics to add to that point? Not just in terms of the technologies we choose to use, which you alluded to, but what are some of the frameworks that could be put in place so that organizational players, whether they be managers or line managers or on the floor staff, can start to take ownership of that whole problem? And I think this is something that came through with several of the other conversations we've had on the show, whether we're talking to Rich or Sharon in the other episodes. But yeah, how do you help people to own the whole problem? Firstly, in terms of choosing the right tools to allow people to use, and secondly, in terms of creating the right framework, structures, protocols, perhaps, instead of just straight up rules. How would you approach that from an organizational perspective?
Yeah, look, I think human agency and talking about ethics, it's ethical agency or moral agency is very important. AI can't own the consequences. It can't. So that gives you all the clues you need to know how you ought to adopt AI within the organization. If you're not doing it in a way that enables me to own more of the decision and the outcome, for me, you're designing for the wrong problem. You're outsourcing the creativity. And that owning of the outcome is really for me what helps me to solve problems, right? The fact that something can go wrong is what helps me to be my best self and to be very, very creative. When you remove that consequence and you make it so low stakes, what is the incentive for me to do my best work? It's very little, right? So I would always say start there. I don't find enough C-suite executives start enough with the mindset of the employees as they engage with these tools. It is there for them to own the whole problem more and more and not less. And often it's the other way around, right? We do it in such a way that they get disempowered. They feel like they don't have to give their best, do their best work. And then eventually things just, tend to go down, right? It's the law of entropy. So I would start there. I think your HR departments are very, very important. That's what we had to do within Altron, is we literally trained our HR team to understand how you ought to adopt AI and how you ought to use it to empower individuals. And they went around the organization with that message. It's there to empower you. You need to own the problem. None of this AI slop, because we're getting a lot of that. It's a problem, right? It's a problem. It's so easy to, that there are all these tells to go, this is from an AI, generated output. So I would start there. They're called mechanical frameworks, how you should, actually adopt it, the policies you need to put in place. There's just so much material now that I feel like I don't have to start there, because I feel like if I start with the cold mechanical, this is the policy, this is the exact framework, this is the exact tool, you're again missing the point. I don't think the point is about starting with the technology. I think the point is around starting with the person. Who are you as a person? How do I empower you to own more of the outcome, more of the consequences, so that you can do more? And yes, when I bring the technology now, it helps you to do more of that and not less of that. So I hope that's helpful. I know it's not as clinical an answer as we've given before, but I think in keeping with this kind of topic, I do think that not enough people, spend enough time around that.
I'm going to push you on that, and maybe Vivian also wants to come in, because yes, that's the problem. But really, where is the problem really? Is it that individuals aren't thinking? Is it that managers aren't training? Is it that hiring departments have hired the wrong people? Is it a case of governance? Where are the breakdowns when it comes to getting people to not stop thinking, but to stop and think when it comes to using these technological tools? Is it a Gen Z problem? Is it a older management problem? Where are the problems lying? Because we hear leaders telling us this is a problem all the time. People aren't thinking. But why is that? Can we scratch a bit further down the causal aid analysis pyramid to figure out where the problem is. Is it a safety issue? Is it a culture issue? Or is it a straight up education and parenting issue that people aren't arriving in the workplace equipped to think for themselves? And maybe you want to come in, Vivian.
I mean, my answer could be yes, it is those issues. But I think what binds all of those issues together, and forgive me, this will be unambiguously self-promoting. So I've got this yellow poster behind me. My book comes out next March, and its title is Robot Proof. And the subtitle is When Machines Have All of the Answers, Build Better People. And that could just be a facile little bit of human promotion, but I'm a hard number scientist. When we look at what humans are uniquely good at versus machines, it provides some insight into the very problem that you're bringing up. If machines have all of the answers, they have all the knowledge. I sometimes describe my own graduate students as knowing everything but understanding nothing. These are brilliant UC Berkeley, Stanford geniuses. I'm not there to teach them facts. This is a very much often a big public misunderstanding about what a PhD is, for example. These are very smart kids. They could go learn all this on their own, especially in a world with LLMs in them. I'm not there to teach them facts. I'm there to teach them how to explore the unknown, the very spot where there aren't facts. And we don't know what the questions are. So the formalism is well-posed problems, things which we already know the answers to, and ill-posed problems, things where we don't even know the question. It is unexplored space. The way we train machine learning systems, modern artificial intelligence, fundamentally boils down to well-posed problems. That by its very nature, here's a question, here's the answer. Train, train, train. Here's 2 million words, predict the next word in the sentence. It's very straightforward in that sense. So right now, we're in a unique point in history. There is this thing which is not human, which is fundamentally better than we are as a collective at answering well-posed questions. You want to know an abstract, arcane answer to some incredibly complex question that would require PhD-trained individuals to answer it? Open up your phone, and you'll get the answer for free in seconds. That is a huge transformation. It's understandable people are frightened. Like, isn't that what the fools like us that got fancy degrees, why do we even have jobs anymore? Well, it's the ill-posed part of the problem. Now I've got the answer. What do I do about it? You don't get a PhD or a law degree or a medical degree to know a bunch of facts. Obviously, it's important that you know facts to be able to operate in these fields. It's what you do about them that matters. Every patient is different. Every contract is different. Every new product development campaign is different than the last one, if only because you're in the future of when the last one happened. It's all ill-posed. We're terrible with uncertainty. And now I'm into my double answer. Managers hate uncertainty because they're humans, and humans hate uncertainty. Some of us, venture capitalists famously in particular, like to think that they ride the edge and they love uncertainty. Nobody does. Human beings do not like uncertainty, and we react very negatively. So the idea that our employees are following standardized metrics feels so good. It means you know what you're getting and what's being delivered. That is a recipe for disaster in the modern world. Quite frankly, if that's all you want, deploy an army of agentic AIs. We aren't there yet, but so hire a bunch of kids off the street around Johannesburg. Give them agentic AIs. Now you've dramatically lowered your human capital costs. They can walk it around the office. You know, you got what you need. If all you're going to do is fulfill a bunch of out of the can metrics, even if the AI itself came up with them. What we truly want, and in my own research, we're looking at this, hybrid intelligence. Right now, the smartest thing on the planet is not Gemini 3, and it's not Terence Tao or some famously brilliant human being. The smartest thing on the planet are teams of human beings, sometimes even rather modestly, slightly above average teams, interacting with an AI. In my own research, we're looking at these teams being able to outperform prediction markets like Polymarket. In research, it does astonishing jobs diagnosing diseases, coming up with new chemical substances in chemical engineering, and again, even in product market development. Teams with AIs are a new thing, and it's because we complement each other. We do the uncertainty. It handles the certain, but then they're fundamentally dynamically networked together. And you see this dynamic of the humans and the machines interacting and interacting and interacting. That's a very long answer, but it boils down to we wish the world was all well-posed problems. Everything had an answer, and all of our education system, our hiring and a lot of our employment and a whole bunch of our management, whether we want to admit it or not, is based on this fundamental idea that everything is about well-posed problems. And unfortunately, everything that's interesting and exciting about the world is an ill-posed problems. And right now, that's where we need humans to be. We need our education system to guide children towards being able to engage with uncertainty and explore the unknown. And yet we're still asking them to answer on demand a bunch of already known things on a sheet of paper. That has to happen to some degree, but we need a totally different transformation. And so, yes, teachers, parents, managers, labor policy by governments, a true and dramatic change.
We're pausing the conversation here, but don't miss part two, where Dr. Vivian Ming reveals how fear turns good people into their own villains and what separates the 11% of employees who drive real organizational value from, well, everyone else. This is Local Logic, brought to you by Altron.
Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron, because local expertise drives global results.